Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Earlier this year, a team of international researchers found that the oceans are heating up 40% faster on average than a United Nations panel estimated just 5 years ago. 93% of the greenhouse gases humans emit are trapped by the oceans, and warming oceans lead to dire consequences for the ecosystem and local economies that depend on fishing. Warmer oceans are also leading to conflict. Waters off of New England's coast are seeing the consequences of climate change firsthand. Over the past 10 years, the Gulf of Maine has warmed faster than 99% of global ocean areas, and that is having a major impact on lobster populations, the fishermen who rely on them, and the local economy that depends on the industry. The new documentary, Lobster War, The Fight Over the World's Richest Fishing Grounds, focuses on a climate-fueled conflict between the United States and Canada over waters that both countries have claimed since the end of the Revolutionary War. The disputed 277 square miles of sea, which is known as the Gray Zone, were traditionally fished by U.S. lobstermen. But as the Gulf of Maine has warmed faster than nearly any body of water on the planet, the area's previously modest lobster population has exploded. And as a result, Canadians have begun to assert their sovereignty, warring with the Americans to claim this bounty of lobsters. Today, we are joined by David Abel, an award-winning environmental reporter with the Boston Globe. He was part of the team that won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for breaking news for the paper's coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings. David previously co-directed and produced the film Sacred Cod. It focuses on the collapse of the cod fishery in New England. And his new film is Lobster War. And David Abel joins us in studio. David was here for the San Francisco International Ocean Film Festival. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And what a beautiful but really kind of scary film, looking at lobsters today and where we might be going. Your last film was about the cod fishery in New England. And during that process, I'm assuming that you learned about lobsters. And is that what motivated you to make this film?
Well, so as a reporter at the Boston Globe covering environmental issues, fisheries is a big part of what I cover. So I am, steeped in all kinds of maritime issues for my day job, and I moonlight as a filmmaker. And so I had learned about the issues with lobster around the same time I'd learned about the issues with cod. But these are parallel stories that are caused arguably by the warming waters in the Gulf of Maine and climate change. But the impact, at least for these two species, is different. And with cod, what we've seen, this is the iconic species of New England that brought settlers from Europe and to the United States and helped sort of found the country and create great wealth in the early years of the colonies. And that warming has caused the collapse to the point that there's now 4 to 6% of what would sustain a healthy stock of cod. And in 2014, the federal government declared a national moratorium on fishing for commercial fishing for cod, which was devastating for many of the fishermen in our area and in New England, and that caused great hardship. And with lobster, with this new film called Lobster War, with that film, what we've seen is the reverse phenomenon, at least in this part of the Gulf of Maine, where lobsters are now in a sweet spot. And that is that, they thrive within a narrow band of temperatures, and they have their population has exploded. But that is not the case further south.
It is incredible to learn about the explosion of lobsters in Maine. So in your film, we learn that in 2016, Maine landed a record 132 million pounds of lobster, which is double the catch in 2000 and seven times the amount in 1950. And there's a lot of money to be made here. The 2016 haul was worth $538 million, nearly three times the value of the 2000 catch. This is one of the most valuable fisheries that has ever existed. So what explains this explosion of lobster in this area?
So as we were just discussing, it is probably the warming waters. Mm-hmm. There are other explanations, and that include the conservation practices that this fishery keeps, which is distinct from many other fisheries. And they often describe the way they protect lobster in this part of the world is akin to aquaculture. And there are hundreds of thousands of lobster traps in the waters from Cape Cod up through Canada or the Maritimes region of Canada. And that involves essentially feeding lobster when they're young and they can get in and out of the lobster pots. And then, you know, they reach a certain point where they can't get out. And so there's a nurturing of them. And there's a whole range of conservation measures to keep them, to keep the small ones in the sea and also the really, really large ones or the older ones that are called the brood stock that provide a lot of the eggs and continue to build the population that helps sustain the population. But the bottom line here is that the warming in the Gulf of Maine has really created a sweet spot, at least in specific parts of the Gulf of Maine, that has allowed in recent years for this surge in the population.
So tell us more about the gray zone. What I love about documentaries is that we can actually spend an hour or more learning about a particular issue and also seeing it. The visual, I think, is really important when we're talking about what's happening with lobster in Maine. I mean, it's such a beautiful area. But tell us more about the gray zone.
So the gray zone is 277 square miles of ocean that surround this rock. And this rock is called Machias Seal Island that both the United States and Canada have claimed since the end of the Revolutionary War. And that rock was kind of meaningless to both countries for generations. It's a puffin colony. It's beautiful. And it wasn't really until the last decade or so that the fishermen on both sides of the border really started to wrangle over this. And that wrangling occurred. Both countries have claimed, they call it the gray zone because it's unclear where the border lies because the Canadians, since the end of the Revolutionary War, have said that the border is in closer to American waters, and the Americans for the same period of time have claimed that it's closer to Canadian waters. And it's basically this oval shaped territory, and both now claim the waters. And since the warming has occurred, as you noted earlier, the Canadians, who long ceded these waters to the Americans, have now said, we're going to fish them too, because there's such a great bounty to catch. And that has caused all kinds of conflict with lobstermen fishing on top of each other. There are really strong tides in this area. It's really hard to fish, especially when there are so many other fishermen, you know, putting these really long connection of lobster traps called lobster trawls, where they'll put like sometimes 15 traps connected by underground lines or water submerged lines. And it's very easy for the tides to pull them on top of each other. And there's also sabotage, and there are people hauling each other's traps. And there's a lot of tension in these waters. And so that's, they call them the gray zone because they don't, they're disputed waters.
And for people who have maybe never seen a lobster trap and don't understand or know how lobsters are caught, can you explain how big the traps are and just what's involved?
Sure. So a lobster trap is a large rectangular box, probably about 4 feet by 2 feet, and their mesh wire, and there is a entry point that's like a valve almost that the lobsters, they usually leave herring as bait inside these lobsters, although that's a whole new issue because the herring catch is another victim of overfishing and climate change, and the herring population has collapsed as well, and we're seeing all kinds of changes in our ecosystem. So the federal government recently declared major cuts to the herring catch, trying to rebuild the herring population. Now they're using raw pig hide as a form of bait. And it's really funny, if you go to lobster towns all throughout New England, you'll see these big buckets of pig hide that they're using to catch lobsters. But they basically keep these inside, and it attracts the lobsters to come in. And the small ones are able to sneak out, usually, although not always. But the bigger ones that they want to catch are stuck, and then they're hauled up.
And so you interviewed a number of fishermen who basically said most of the tension is about the money. Everybody wants it. People are working year round, and people are making a lot of money. On average, what does a lobsterman make, especially someone who's out there on a regular basis right now?
Well, it's all about effort. And despite my, deep intrigue and curiosity and investigative prowess, They don't share that detail. But you can see how they're doing in the new additions to their homes and their shiny new Ford F-150 trucks. You could see it in the newer boats that they're buying. So at least for now, they're doing just fine.
We learn that they're competing for the same resource, the Canadians and the Americans, but they're living by different rules. They use different gear. Maine marine patrols have increased at night when Canadians are allowed to fish, but people in Maine are not allowed to fish. And as you report in the movie, Canadian officials declined to comment on their patrols.
Right. Let me just go back to the question you asked before. I just want to say that, as well off as some of these fishermen might be at the moment, these are the hardest working people you have ever seen. Mm-hmm. Just filming them is tiring. Just watching them out at sea. I mean, they are, they're arguably, among our last hunter gatherers, and they are out before dawn sometimes, and, out really late in the day, and they are pulling up these really heavy traps, and it's dangerous work. They have these ropes that are constantly moving on their decks. It'd be so easy to get an ankle caught in one of these things, and being a fisherman is among the most dangerous jobs in this country, and we often see fishermen pay the price for it.
And people take that for granted. People go to the store and they order lobster, and they don't think about this.
Totally.
In fact, you interviewed one man who lost his thumb.
Right, right. And so that, there are all kinds of dangers of fishing. In this case, the dangers are multiplied because they're fishing in such crowded waters, mm-hmm. and there's so much tension. And, there is, hostility between the different sides. And to go to to the question you just asked, there is different law enforcement authorities from different countries, and there are different regulations pertaining to the different fishermen. The fishermen in Canada can fish at night, and the fishermen from Maine and the United States can't. And actually, one of the main characters in the film recently got arrested because he was caught fishing at night, and he went to trial, and he's now pressing, lawmakers in Maine to change the law so fishermen, at least in that part of the world, in the gray zone, can fish at night so that they can keep up with the Canadians.
Today, we're speaking with David Abel about his new documentary, Lobster War, the fight over the world's richest fishing grounds. It's about a climate-fueled conflict between the United States and Canada over waters that both countries have claimed since the end of the Revolutionary War. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. David is in town for the International Ocean Film Festival. We did a show about that now 2 weeks ago. David is an award-winning environmental reporter with the Boston Globe. He previously co-directed and produced Sacred Cod. This is a film about the collapse of the cod fishery in New England. And it's also important, you reminded me, just talking about how dangerous this work is. In addition to lobster feeding the families of these fishermen and how much is at stake, if this industry collapses like it has south of New York, you went to several different towns in Maine and talked to people about how this industry is also supporting the entire town.
True. So you have basically one species that provides for thousands of people, and coastal Maine thrives and is heavily and has been increasingly reliant on this one creature from the sea, lobster. And if there were to be a collapse, as there was south of Cape Cod over the last decade, from Cape Cod through Long Island Sound, we've seen a collapse of some 90% of the lobster catch. And that put hundreds of lobstermen and other business owners who provided, you know, supplies and fuel and all kinds of other things to the lobstermen in that area out of business. Mm. And it was devastating. And we talk about that in our film as well.
You did. You met one man who said some people made it and some didn't. And this particular man is a woodworker who makes these beautiful wood sculptures of fish, lobster and fish. But what does happen to these communities? I mean, we know now because, as you said, 90% of the lobster catch has declined. What happened in those communities?
Well, there was a lot of suffering. There was in a place like Stonington, Connecticut, which is on Long Island Sound and parts of Rhode Island, lobstermen in these areas have to find a new source of income. And this one gentleman in our film, you know, now is a sculptor, and he likes to say they can't get away from him now that he's actually carving them up. That said, while there was a thriving and significant lobster fishery in parts of Rhode Island and Long Island and Connecticut, it was nothing like what exists today in Maine, and there are far more opportunities to find other kinds of livelihoods there than in, let's say, down east Maine, where the entire economy centers around lobster. And without lobster, we would see a lot more poverty and a lot of repercussions.
Some of the men you interviewed in the film expressed frustration with the government, especially when it comes to rules around the gray zone. Did you talk to any lobstermen who are no longer lobstermen about climate change? Are they now raising hell on this issue? Because they've been affected by it firsthand.
Right. So it's interesting. Talking to fishermen, they're not always likely to agree with scientists, in part because the science often leads to regulations, and those regulations can lead to quota cuts. And so they have an interest in being skeptical about these things. And that is the case for a lot of fisheries. And that was particularly the case for the groundfish in my last film, Sacred Cod. And that film really is about a conflict between fishermen and scientists over what is, you know, the right quota levels for this species that science says is in peril. And all the surveys suggest has collapsed to something like 4 to 6% of what would sustain a healthy species of cod. But lobstermen, I found, were different than a lot of the other fishermen I've interviewed over the years, in that they have an intimate understanding of how the changing temperatures are affecting the species that they catch. And they see it in their shells. So it's not just the warming of the waters, but the absorption of the water, the absorption of all this carbon dioxide in the water. The waters are the primary reservoir. Our oceans are a primary reservoir for carbon dioxide. And that carbon dioxide changes the pH balance of the water and causes the waters to become more acidic. And that acidic change causes this very carefully nurtured ecological balance in how shells are formed in shellfish. It causes that to change. And we see an increasing amount of shell disease, or softer shells that are not, you know, what nature intended for a lot of these species to change. And that makes them more vulnerable and less marketable. Hmm. And so you can't really sell a lobster with shell disease. And so lobstermen, for the most part, are in tune with these changes. They understand the risks far more than, or they're willing to acknowledge the risks far more than a lot of other fishermen I have interviewed.
And they have seen what has happened south of Cape Cod.
And they've seen very clearly what can happen when the waters warm past a certain point that lobsters can take on a regular basis. And that has led to a major change in an ecosystem that would be an economic catastrophe if it occurred in Maine.
Are they preparing for what might come?
Well, not really. Yeah. fishermen are, you know, by nature, people who are very present-minded, and they are, you know, up and ready to catch what they can while they can. And they're also heavily invested in that catch. And they've been investing more so, especially in the regions where they've been making money, buying new boats, buying new gear, buying new trucks. And so to pay for all of those investments, they are hoping to continue that significant catch that they've had for years now.
Today, we're speaking with David Abel about his new film, Lobster War, The Fight Over the World's Richest Fishing Grounds. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. You can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it is our One Planet series, and we're joined by David Abel, an award-winning environmental reporter with the Boston Globe. He co-directed and produced Sacred Cod, a film about the collapse of the cod fishery in New England. And his latest film is called Lobster War, The Fight Over the World's Richest Fishing Grounds. It's about a climate-fueled conflict between the U.S. and Canada over waters that both countries have claimed since the end of the Revolutionary War. shore. The disputed 277 square miles of sea, known as the Gray Zone, were traditionally fished by U.S. lobstermen, but as the Gulf of Maine has warmed faster than nearly any other body of water on the planet, the area's previously modest lobster population has surged, and Canadians have begun to assert their sovereignty. And you can see the trailer Lobster War at yourcallradio.org. David is in town for the Ocean Film Festival in San Francisco. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take your phone calls. And David, for people who want to see Lobster War, where can they see it? Is it still being screened right now and at film festivals?
So we're in the middle of a theatrical campaign, and we have been screening the film all throughout New England at independent theaters and at film festivals now beyond our region. So this was our West Coast premiere. This is the first time we were showing the film outside of our region. We are this weekend going to be showing the film at the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. as part of the Environmental Film Festival. And we'll be showing it at film festivals going forward over the coming months. And at some point, we'll be releasing it digitally.
Oh, great.
And you can see more about that on our website or our Facebook pages, and hopefully we can post links for those. But our website is lobsterwar.com, and we post regularly on where the screenings are, and we will clearly be letting folks know when we release it digitally. And we also are in the process of deciding about how we will distribute it on television.
Oh, great. Hopefully PBS will pick it up.
Well, that's
that would be fantastic.
We're in conversations with them, and that's a possibility.
What conversation did the film spark when you screened it in Maine?
So before you screen any film, it is incredibly nerve-wracking, and you never know how people are gonna respond or what they're gonna say. And before we showed it to anyone, we were promoting it online and letting people know. And the title, Lobster War, rankled people. And the subtitle, too, The Fight Over the World's Richest Fishing Grounds. And, you know, we had to try to explain to people we weren't trying to take some sort of sensational point of view here. We weren't trying to inflame the situation. And there were reasonable concerns that people had. You know, they never know what your agenda is going to be. And we were really fortunate. The premiere of the film was at a film festival in Maine. It was as close to the setting of the film as we could get. And when we talk about down east Maine, we're talking about the border, the coastal area of Maine that goes from the mid coast up to the Canadian border, pretty much, and. We had a really amazing turnout. There were a bunch of fishermen from the film who came, and their relatives and mother-in-laws and state officials and lobster biologists and representatives from Canada were there too. Mm. So with a subject matter as fraught as this that hasn't really been portrayed in this kind of way before, we weren't sure what the response was going to be, and we were really gratified that we got, you know, invited back for screenings in Canada and elsewhere in Maine. And the fishermen on both sides said really, you know, they really feel like they were treated fairly and thought that the film was nuanced and thoughtful and wasn't trying to take pot shots at anyone and was trying to really do justice to this issue that is arguably, you know, being spurred on by the changing climate.
And I'm guessing they all realize we desperately need to have this conversation.
Not all of them realize that. But clearly, you know, I think more and more do and increasingly recognize the need for having a conversation about how their place that their families have fished for generations in many cases is changing at an accelerating pace, at a pace that nobody had anticipated, and they worry what the legacy will be for their children, and whether there'll be this bounty left for anyone to fish in the coming decades.
I have never bought lobster, so I'm not sure these numbers are right, but we looked them up and we found that most Americans will spend between $30 and $45 on a 1.5-pound lobster at a restaurant, and lobster rolls can cost up to $20. Is that right?
That sounds about right. Like you, I actually am allergic to lobster, and I never have bought it. And, I have an aversion to all seafood. I seem to write about them and make films about them, but they cause my stomach to turn. So I do know, though, that they are really expensive.
Why is that? How did lobster become such a lucrative item?
It has to do with supply and demand. Even though the supply has spiked, the demand has risen with it. Hmm. It used to be that lobster was considered like the bastard fish of the sea. And, 50, 100 years ago, people did not eat lobster, and it was not considered a delicacy by any stretch. But, of course, maybe marketing has taken, it has helped, but people obviously like the taste of lobster, even if you or I don't, the supply has gone up substantially, but the demand has gone well beyond my region in New England and Maritime Canada throughout the world, and we've seen a huge spike in demand in Asia. Mm. And so there was, until recently, a thriving export market and a growing export market to China. But since our fearless president declared a trade war with the Chinese, that has caused all kinds of issues with exports to Canada, exports from the United States to China.
Are lobsters in Maine exported anywhere else?
Oh, yeah.
Outside of the U.S., I mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're exported to Europe. They're exported throughout the world.
And the fishermen that you met, are they selling their lobster mostly in the U.S. or overseas, or is it just a mixture?
So they have relationships with wholesalers, and it's actually a strange way the lobster ends up getting sold, because even before the trade issues between the United States and China and the United States and Canada, again, our fearless president has stoked some trade tensions with our friends across the border in Canada as well. But despite that, a lot of the lobster and some other fish that is caught in Maine and elsewhere in New England gets sent across the border to Canada to get processed, and then sometimes gets sent back to the States to get sold here. Mm-hmm. Our biggest market, of course, is still here in the States. But one way that lobster caught in Maine still is exported to China is because it ends up going to wholesalers who process the lobster in Canada, and then the Canadians sell it to China. So it's kind of this, very complicated, in some cases, almost incestuous sort of relationship between people who have been working together for a long time.
You talked about how difficult the work is on the boat. The work after the lobsters are caught is also incredibly difficult. I mean, you have footage of what looked to me like mostly people of color who are, is it called shucking? Is that right?
Yes.
Shucking the lobster. I mean, it is work. Slicing, cutting, throwing, catching. I mean, they're covered in this stuff. Do you know if these people, I'm guessing mostly immigrants, are they treated well? Are they paid a living wage?
When you go into these lobster processing plants, it is one of those "there but for the grace of God go I" moments. Mm-hmm. Where you realize, no matter how hard you think your life is, or no matter how, hard your morning was, wow.
Yeah.
The work that these guys do is intense, back-breaking, and dangerous. They're working often with sharp knives, and they are moving at a breakneck pace to shuck the meat from the shells, and they get these huge mounds of lobster parts that they're cutting up and that they're piling into these vats. And it's tough. And most of the labor are now on special, come in on special visas, or are immigrants, you know, here from other ways, and they are working often at minimum wage to support this otherwise thriving industry.
So even though there's major profits happening right now, the people doing the very difficult work, men and women, they're making minimum wage.
I can't speak for all lobster processors,
right.
And I don't know the pay scale, but they're not earning a lot of money.
Mm. Today, we're speaking with David Abel about his new film, Lobster War, The Fight Over the World's Richest Fishing Grounds. And you can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. As David said, the film will eventually be released digitally. You can find more information at lobsterwar.com. David is here for the San Francisco International Film Festival. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. One of my favorite people in the film is Diane Cowan, founder of the Lobster Conservancy. And I have to say, you know, when we do shows about climate change and the climate crisis, it can be pretty daunting and pretty depressing. But when you meet people like Diane who dedicate their lives to an animal, or in this case, really learning about a lobster, I mean, it's kind of amazing that she started this organization to better understand lobsters. She lives in Friendship, Maine. What a great name for a town, to study lobsters. She's been there since May of 1999. So she basically spends her days with the lobsters, learning how they live, how they reproduce, and what's in store for their future. What an amazing, interesting woman.
She is a character by every definition. She is super smart and incredibly committed and beyond diligent. And she has, for years, lived almost, you know, like a hermit's life on an island through, you know, the most difficult winters. Sometimes she's had to have food airdropped to her because she can't get out because the bay that surrounds the island freezes. And she is intent on understanding what the future of lobsters is. And what she does is vital to all the people who go out to sea every day. And she, you know, is in the muck, knee deep, literally, looking for baby lobsters and measuring them and tracking them. And she's been doing this for years. Mm. And I was really fortunate that she welcomed me into her lair and showed me around. And to see her house on this island, it's really fun. We weren't able to get all of this into the film, but I mean, there is not, I think, a corner of her house that does not have some lobster iconography in it. It's really intense.
So she's doing this with her dog, and it's almost as if the dog understands what she's doing is in assisting her. You can almost see that in the dog's face. What drives her to do this?
You know, it's a great question. I actually was learning more about her work by reading this book called The Secret Life of Lobsters. And she has been fascinated, like I think a lot of people, by this creature that has meant so much to so many people throughout not just New England anymore, but throughout the world. I mean, lobster, you know, is a vital species, and it's also an icon, and it's a delicacy. It's coveted, and it also portends, you know, greater issues about, you know, how our world is changing, and understanding how this species that can only really thrive within a very specific set of circumstances, just like everybody else on this planet, we all live in this very, you know, rare amalgamation of oxygen and nitrogen. Mm-hmm. And you change things like adding too much carbon dioxide or methane to the atmosphere, And it doesn't take too much for it to cause huge numbers of species to no longer be able to exist. And at some point, that could eventually include us. But we're talking about lobster, and lobster only can exist within a very specific, you know, set of circumstances. The oxygen in the water has to be just right. You know, too much carbon dioxide in the water, their shells won't grow, or they'll grow in a different way, and disease will likely, you know, ravage them. And the same for temperature. And she understands that, and I think that guides her work.
And so just to elaborate on this, lobsters, they're cold water animals, and they cannot regulate their own body temperatures.
Right.
So if the water doesn't get sufficiently cold in the winter months, what happens to these lobsters?
Well, I think it has to be within a certain band of temperatures. And what happens is their shells, they won't grow properly. Their bodies, they have to molt over multiple stages in their development, and if their bodies aren't growing at the proper rate with the right temperatures, then they can't survive.
And they also won't produce enough eggs or sperm. This is another interesting fact. It takes a decade for lobster to reach sexual maturity and reproduce.
Right.
They can live for many, many decades. And as she said, Diane Cowan said, when you see a big one, they've really been through a lot. And it's really important to have those survivors in the population.
Absolutely. And that also accounts for some of the regulations. So in the United States or in these waters off Maine, the state of Maine strictly prohibits catching lobster over a certain size. And the reason is that they provide a huge portion of the eggs to regenerate the population. But in this area that the film centers on, the gray zone, there is great conflict over those kinds of lobsters because the Canadian regulations permit them to catch the brood stock, the larger lobsters. And that is one significant source of tension between lobstermen from both sides.
That's a huge source of tension. How is that regulated?
Well, each country regulates it on its own. Mm-hmm. So for the Canadians, their national regulations are what apply, and so they abide by their country's regulations in the gray zone. And in the gray zone for the Americans, they have to abide by their national regulations.
And I think Diane, when she said, stated this, said this sentence, I mean, this says it all. If lobsters cannot find deep, cold water, they are doomed.
That, sadly, is probably the case.
So new research has found that lobsters are moving north by 4 miles a year, and they're expected to shift another 200 miles by the year 2100.
So there's a really group of researchers out of Rutgers University in New Jersey, and they do a lot of work on the shifting range of species. Lobster, as well as many other species, are having their traditional migratory patterns or their habitats change because of changes in currents like the Gulf Stream or the other ocean currents. And the temperatures are pushing many species, such as lobster, further to cooler waters or waters that they've been bred by centuries to adapt to. And we're seeing major shifts that could, in some cases, possibly lead to a natural resolution to this crisis that we're currently experiencing in the gray zone, and that is, if lobsters continue to move north, they might eventually all sort of migrate into Canadian waters.
Wow.
Or the substantial portion of them. And, you know, a lot of the tension in the gray zone.
I mean, if this continues, if climate change continues at the current rate, how are fisheries around the world going to adapt?
Well,
I mean, the changes, it's really incredible to think about the changes that we are seeing happening right now. This is not something that we're predicting to happen a couple of generations. in the future. That's what's so incredible about all of this.
Absolutely. And we are seeing all kinds of conflicts over traditional fisheries just in our own waters in the United States. We are seeing one species, black sea bass, that was traditionally a fish that was caught in the Mid-Atlantic region, and it is now being found increasingly in Rhode Island and off Massachusetts and further north, even in Maine. And we're seeing that the quotas for that catch remain in places like North Carolina. And that has caused fishermen in those waters to have to steam all the way up to Rhode Island to catch their quota. And the fishermen in Rhode Island are not given the right quota, are not given the quota that would reflect, you know, what the fishery is in their waters. And so there is great tension within our own country over, you know, who should be catching what. And those tensions are likely to increase as the species continue to shift and federal regulations have to adapt to account for climate change and the movement of these species. And they're slowly starting to find ways to do that.
What are you hearing from, say, for example, state government officials on this issue? Do they realize how serious this is?
Absolutely. I mean, it depends, obviously, on the state.
Right.
But in our region, states are increasingly lobbying for their fishing communities and, you know, pressing the agencies that oversee fishing and the councils that oversee these conflicts to change the rules so that, you know, they can take part in the catch. As black sea bass move into New England, you know, they are in some cases taking over for where cod was, and they could provide a replacement possibly. So if they're in our waters, why shouldn't we be able to catch them is the ethos. But the problem is that the quotas are divvied up by historical measures more than current measures.
I was thinking about how the Green New Deal is being covered in the national media and how the Republicans are now bringing out the socialism word. I mean, when you look at climate change, I mean, here in California, we're dealing with major fires. It is so cold right now. It's been raining like we have not seen in a while. And then you've got flooding, hurricanes, so many other issues. And then this one, looking at just how the waters are changing fishing patterns and livelihoods, there's a lot at stake here.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons why I wanted to make Lobster War and our previous film, Sacred Cod, is because it can get really dense, a conversation about atmospheric emissions and modeling for the future. But we are seeing the impact of climate change very clearly, very simply in our waters. And our film, I hope, if there's one takeaway, it's that climate change is not some distant or abstract phenomenon or threat, but it's one that is actually now having an impact on people's lives, and we're seeing it in our most iconic species.
Final thoughts. I mean, given everything that's happening and just given the fact that you're so close to it, where do you see this going? I mean, what do you think needs to happen next in terms of the conversation that's happening? With this administration, they're deregulating so much. I mean, we've done so many shows about the EPA and how people have left. It's been so hollowed out. I mean, obviously you can't predict, but what concerns you the most given all of the reporting you've done?
Wow. We have to be taking these issues seriously. It is the IPCC, United Nations report of late last year, the National Climate Assessment, which came out afterward, and many, many studies that have been done, not just in this country, but around the world, reflect that we have a major crisis. And that is that we are pumping more and more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into our atmosphere. And we have reached a point where they are playing more of a role in our lives, and they will do so even more. And we're seeing that temperatures are likely to rise in the next 20 years considerably. And if we pass a certain point, we run the risk of changes that are going to make certain places uninhabitable, like Central California. Mm. Like when forest fires are something that you can't control, that you know, take over wide swaths of your state, we have to start rethinking how we live.
David Abel is an award-winning environmental reporter with the Boston Globe. You can check out his last film, Sacred Cod. It's about the collapse of the cod fishery in New England. And his latest film is Lobster War, the fight over the world's richest fishing grounds. Find more information at lobsterwar.com, and the film will soon be released digitally. David, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls, One Planet.